You are listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast featuring some of Indiana's most fascinating men and women whose impact has shaped our state, our communities, and us. Join us as we discuss their imprint on our history. Leaders and Legends is brought to you by Veteran Strategies Incorporated, your local veteran business enterprise specializing in public relations, media relations, public outreach, crisis communications, and digital photography. My name is Robert Bain, Principal of Veteran Strategies, former Deputy Chief of Staff to Mayor Greg Ballard, and Communications Director for the Indiana Republican Party. I'm honored to be your host for our discussion. Thank you for joining us on the Leaders and Legends podcast. Our guest today is former Mayor Bart Peterson. Very gracious of you, Mayor, to join us today. We appreciate your time and are excited for today's conversation. You're a lifelong Indianapolis resident and one of a gaggle of distinguished North Central High School grads. Talk to us a little bit, please, about growing up in Indianapolis.
Well, first of all, Robert, thank you for having me. And I don't know how I compare to some of the truly distinguished North Central High School grads. It's produced a lot of terrific leaders, not just here in the city and state, but nationally. But it was also a very big high school. And I had almost 1,200 in my graduating class. And that was quite an experience. It prepared me for the world in a unique way. I think being part of a big high school, a diverse high school, was almost like a city in and of itself. I think had me well prepared for this world that I ended up going into later on in life.
Well, so far we've had North Central grads Mitch Daniels, and we've had Mark Miles. We haven't had distinguished North Central grad Kip Two on yet.
Well, you're remiss in that. I'm sure you'll get around to it.
And you were kind of in between that group. Did you know the Daniels family? Did you know the Miles family? Were you proximate and kind of where you grew up?
No, I didn't. I grew up with four siblings, and I was the four siblings. I was the fourth of five, and starting with my oldest sister, who's 6 years older than me, down to my youngest, who's 3 years younger, we cover the gamut, and there's usually somebody in there who went to school with somebody who went to North Central, some family. So we covered a pretty good range, but no, the Daniels family and the Miles family didn't overlap with me.
One of the things that I've said, and you're about 10 years older than me, I grew up in Irvington on the east side. I never came downtown except to see Dick the Bruiser.
You remember Dick the Bruiser.
Very well. Yeah, Ernie the Big Cat Lad, the Valiant Brothers, obviously Andre the Giant. What was it like to be a teenager in Indianapolis in the time that you were on the cusp of the city, really downtown, exploding?
Well, I think maybe the 10 years difference between us is meaningful, because I will tell you, I think I remember downtown when it still had some life to it. So it actually literally died while I was, you know, in my formative years. I remember coming to the Indiana Theater when it was still open as a movie theater. It was pretty rudimentary as in terms of amenities. I remember they had Dixie cups with orange juice in them. That was the concession stand. Orange juice and water. But they had a big screen, and I remember seeing Dr. Doolittle there, and that was probably right. That would have been 1964, I think, probably right before it closed. No, Dr. Doolittle was the guy who talked to the animals. I can't remember who was the star of that, but in any case, that place closed shortly thereafter. The downtown department stores were still open when I was young. Downtown really started to lose its, its attractions while I was a kid. And so it wasn't probably until I came back to Indianapolis from law school when I was 25 years old that you could really see a meaningful difference. The changes started way before that, with Market Square Arena being built in the early 70s. So the revival of downtown was well underway by then. But I unfortunately got to see it go down. But then fortunately, I got to watch it come back up pretty significantly, so that by the time I was mayor, we were on a very significant upward trajectory.
College at Purdue and law school at Michigan. Why did you choose those two universities?
Well, Purdue was the family school. Neither of my parents went to college. My oldest sister chose Purdue, and it became the place where we were, I think, all expected to go. I was not a great high school student. And I was grateful that back then Purdue was easier to get into than it is today, particularly if you were not an engineering major, and I was certainly not. But I never even thought about going anywhere else, because it was just sort of in the family DNA, I guess, to go to Purdue. So all five of us kids went to Purdue. My youngest sister, who got married very young, she got married after her sophomore year in college, and moved to a guy from Philadelphia, and moved to Philadelphia and graduated from Temple. But she at least had 2 years in at Purdue, and all the other rest of us are all Purdue graduates.
Your parents were down with that marriage?
They were okay with it. Yes, I'm sure they were a little in retrospect. As I look back at it, I was pretty young then too. But as I look back at it, I'm sure they were a little concerned. But she's done very, very well. She's built a great life out in the Philadelphia area. She's the only one of my siblings who doesn't live in central Indiana. So all the rest of us are still here. My father passed away about 5 years ago, but my mother is still alive and doing very, very well. So we're fortunate to have all of them still around, with the exception of my younger sister, who comes back with some frequency. And we just saw her the other day too.
My family's from New Jersey and spent a lot of time in Philadelphia. It's a wonderful, wonderful city. You graduated from high school, I'm going to guess, 76, 77?
76, yeah.
Was it in the mid-70s, mid to late 70s, high school, college at Purdue, that your political philosophy was formed? Tumultuous times in the United States? Or did you find yourself drifting one way or another before then?
I talked to a teacher in my daughter's school back when she was very young, 10, 11, 12. And I remember him telling me something that has stuck with me ever since. He said, if you're going to develop a worldview, not everybody does, but if you're going to develop a worldview, you tend to develop it when you're around that age, 10, 11, 12, and that what's going on in the world will have a big influence on you at that age. It's a particularly formative age, according to him. And as I look back, that really resonated with me, because I was 10 years old in 1968, the tumultuous year when I can't imagine those years, 68, 69, 70. I can't imagine being the age I am today. I would have thought the world was falling apart. And I'm sure my parents did and grandparents did. But somehow we as a country survived, and we as a world survived. But I think my worldview was significantly impacted by that era.
Watergate included?
Watergate, yeah, a little bit later on, but I think probably the assassination of Dr. King and the tail end of what we think of as the civil rights movement had a pretty profound impact on me. Racial justice and issues of fair treatment of all people have always been a pretty profound issue with me. Maybe the most profound issue in determining my political leanings and ideology, and I can't help but think that it was influenced by the events of 68, 69, 70.
Why Michigan for law school?
It was the best law school I got into.
I was going to say, you weren't allowed to go to IU.
Now, I'm very happy that I went to Michigan Law School. Some of my closest friends to this day are my classmates from the Michigan Law class of 1983, and it was a great place to go to school. Ann Arbor is a terrific town, and Most importantly, I met my wife in Ann Arbor. We were married there, and she's a rabid Michigan football fan. So in spite of my Purdue leanings, I now own season tickets for the University of Michigan's football team.
And you go up there for every home game?
Oh, no, not every one of them, but we probably make about half of them.
I'm going to date this podcast. It's the being recorded the Tuesday before the Notre Dame-Michigan game in October. Are you going to make that one?
Yes. Not only am I going to make that one, but we sold to benefit Crystal House. We sold a package of joining me for the Denver Broncos-Indianapolis Colts game the very next day, which I thought would be no problem at all, given that the Notre Dame-Michigan game would be on Saturday. I could sleep in Ann Arbor, drive home, and make it to the 4:30 game. Then they changed the time of the game, so I'm going to be getting out of bed about 5 o'clock in the morning on Sunday and coming down for the Colts game. But yes, we will be at the Michigan Notre Dame game, and I'm not going to say anything negative about your Irish fans out there, because I actually like the University of Notre Dame, and I'll be rooting for Michigan, but I won't be as rabid as my wife will be.
I won't tell the McGinleys at the Golden Knights. I promise.
Thank you.
Did you come right back to Indianapolis after graduating from law school?
I did. I came back and worked for the law firm of Ice Miller, Donatio and Ryan, which is almost the same name today, Ice Miller. And I worked there for almost 6 years before I went into government.
Did you enjoy it? We had our podcast with Governor Daniels, and he said, as I recall, Spangle, he said he malpracticed law for a while.
I would not say I was the best lawyer at that law firm at all, nor was I perhaps born to be a practicing lawyer. I love the law, and to this day, you know, if I was, and I actually do this occasionally, rarely, but occasionally, I'll read a law review article or something if it's on a related related issue to something that I'm doing, and I really enjoy the law. I just for whatever reason, probably not the most adept practitioner, but I knew fairly early on I probably was not going to be a career lawyer. I look at those folks that I started with at the law firm who have stayed and have made a successful career, and I kind of envy them for the stability of their lives. I have chosen to bounce around and do a million different things, whereas they've had a lot more stability than I have. But I realized within a few years that it was probably not the ideal profession for me.
Coming back to Indianapolis as a Democrat in the mid-ish 80s, you look at the state and you look at city government and you wonder, perhaps, when's it going to be our time? And it came, fair to say, more quickly than perhaps expected in 1988 when Evan Bayh wins the governor's office. Were you involved in that campaign? Did you know then Secretary of State Bayh? And what did you think about that turn of events?
I did. And I agree with you. I think it had not been for Evan Bayh, the status quo would have remained for a much longer time. So there had been no Democrat-elected governor of Indiana for the 20 years leading up to Governor Bayh's election. And I can't imagine anybody else who could have won.
Because he beat a damn good man.
1988. He absolutely did. Somebody who had not just paid his dues, but really served the state incredibly well and honorably. And it was a tough, tough race. But I actually, in 1985, January of 85, I remember I went to a luncheon and heard Evan Bayh speak for the first time. And I decided I was going to sign up for that program. I was really impressed by him personally. And I did a little bit of work on his Secretary of State's campaign in 1986. And then about the middle of 87, when I think it was pretty open secret that he was going to run for governor in 88, I asked if I could be the environmental issues advisor for his campaign.
Did you practice environmental law?
I did practice environmental law. That I had sort of about the middle of my 6-year stint with the law firm, I became the person who was responsible for their environmental issues in business transactions. So became kind of a hot issue area at that time. Environmental lawyers were pretty in demand then, and actually did enjoy practicing environmental law and learned all of the key statutes: the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Superfund law, all of those laws. And I believe that the environment was likely to be a meaningful issue in the 88 campaign. And I told the governor's campaign manager, who at the time who today is the current mayor of Indianapolis, and at the time was just a lawyer who was Evan's campaign manager. That was before he became Secretary of State. And I thought there'd be a long line of people waiting to be the environmental advisor to the Evan Bayh for Governor campaign, but Joe immediately said, "You want it? You're it. Done." And I spent a fair amount of time working on that campaign. And then when he was elected, he asked me to join his staff as his environmental advisor. And so that's what I did initially for the first couple years. Then I became the deputy chief of staff. Then I became the chief of staff. So I ended up being, I thought I'd do a 2-year stint with him after he was elected, and I ended up staying 6.5 years, almost his entire time.
I'm going to guess that you made more money at the law firm than you did working for state government.
Well, that is an interesting, you're correct, although it was fairly close because I was a year away from when I would have been considered to be a partner in the law firm and was still making an associate's salary. And so it didn't, had I gone from a partner's salary to a state government salary, it would have been a little more painful, but it ended up being not too bad a transition. The difference is it basically never went up the entire 6.5 years. I think when I left, I was making about $1,000 more than when I started.
But, okay, so I have to ask, who is the most frugal? You, current mayor Joe Hogsett, former governor Evan Bayh?
Oh, that's a really good question. I clearly finished third in that contest. Those two are crazy. They're
you finished third in a good way, right? You finished
well.
Third
I finished
in a good
third
way.
In a profligate way. I guess. the two of them are extremists when it comes to being frugal with the public.
So when you go to lunch money. Or dinner with them,
I think it's personal as well as professional with them. Yes.
So who has the best set of alligator arms?
They're both wonderful people, but they practice frugality in all aspects of their lives. But and I will tell you, all kidding aside, I part of the reason why that's built into their way of governing, their way of being involved as public figures. If you think back to that era, it was Democrats were just beaten into dust as a result of sort of being pro tax increase, and everywhere you turn, Democrats wanted to raise your taxes. That was sort of the stereotype that was effectively used against Democrats in all campaigns. And Evan Bayh was a brilliant politician and a great person. You know, he knew that, and it came naturally to him. I'm dead serious. It really did come naturally to him. And again, I'm joking a little bit about the personal side, but he really believed that it was critical to prove that Democrats could govern in a fiscally responsible way. And of course, Joe was right there beside him, and they have never wavered in the 30 plus years since that time in their commitment to spending the public's money wisely, which I think is a big part of why they've been successful.
But folks, a lot of people, myself included, take significant pay cuts to go work for government, city or state, and I'm assuming federal in some cases, because you want to be, there's some proximity to power and influence, of course, you can't ignore that. But you get a chance to do really amazing things, and this is obviously before you're mayor, but you're chief of staff and you're in the governor's office, and you can really influence in a good way projects and things that are near and dear Hoosiers. And to me, as much as I missed the money, I enjoyed the experience more. So leaving Ice Miller and going to the State House, did you ever regret it?
No, you're exactly right. I feel exactly the same way you did. And the truth is you grow up so quickly because the responsibility is thrust on you. I was 30 years old. I had been practicing law for almost 6 years, but I was still, you know, I was still an associate. I was still a pretty junior person. The level of responsibility I got in state government was dramatically different. All of a sudden, I was calling the shots in my little area there. I ended up being the chief of staff to the governor, and which is sort of tantamount to being the chief operating officer of state government, which is a multi-billion dollar operation with many thousands of employees. And I could not have had that. Doing anything else, I don't think I would have gotten that level of responsibility that quickly. So not only do you have the ability to have some impact on public affairs and events and public policy, which, you know, people like you and I who go into this love that kind of thing, but you also get a chance to develop leadership traits that I think, certainly in my case, and I think in most people's cases, serve you well later on. So I look at the group that I started with in Evan Bayh's office. We were 30, 31, 29. The governor himself was only 32 when he was elected. and, you know, we've all gone on to leadership, different leadership roles. And it's the same thing with my administration as mayor. We had a little reunion the other day. I'm so proud of the team that I had a chance to work with, and not just what they did then, but what they've done since then. And I believe a big part of that is the fact that you have so much responsibility, and typically, frequently, because of the pay and other reasons, at a young age. And it was a great proving ground for me. I know when I became mayor, one of the advantages that I had, and I think this was quite a significant one, was that I had sat in an executive office for 6.5 years, in this case, the governor's office, and I had seen crises come and go. And I had, a certain calmness about impending disasters, or what looked like impending disasters, because I'd seen so many impending disasters and realized most of them don't actually turn into disasters. They really look like they're going to be disasters, but they turn out to sort of fizzle out or go away. And that experience and then the true disasters that actually do happen, you learn how to deal with them, right? And so when I became mayor, I had a fair amount of experience with dealing with things that were really bad that had to be dealt with, and also looking at a lot of things that looked like they might turn bad and not panicking about them, because I knew most of them probably would resolve themselves, and those that didn't, we'd figure out how to solve them because we'd done it before. And that really put me in a good position when I became mayor. So being a staff person to an executive branch official, I'm sure the same thing is true for legislative staffers as well. I just never served in that kind of a role. But in my case, it was a huge advantage. And I look at our state, and I know that in the governor's office, I don't know all very many of the staffers there, but I'm sure they're having the same experience that I did. And a lot of future leaders in our state are going to come out of that office. And just the same with Mayor Hogsett's office here in Indianapolis. So it's a great proving ground for young people. The only thing it lacks is good pay.
And they're all underpaid. Everyone in state government is ever underpaid. Everyone in city government's underpaid. I mean, the hours you put in are remarkable, and the scrutiny you're under is almost immeasurable. But you do it because you love your city and you love your state.
Very true.
You are listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast presented by Veteran Strategies, a local veteran public relations enterprise, and sponsored by Girl Scouts of Central Indiana, the Crown Plaza Hotel and Grand Hall and Conference Center at historic Union Station, and McAllister Machinery, your friendly neighborhood Caterpillar dealer. Fast forward a few years. There's a mayoral election in 1999. It's going to be an open seat. Previous mayor Steve Goldsmith, who had lost the 96 gubernatorial election to Frank O'Bannon, decides not to run for a third term. Open seats don't happen very often. What made you think that Bart Peterson could break the 32-year stranglehold on the mayor's office by the Republican Party?
Well, for one thing, I think it's worth pointing out, Robert, that I didn't know it was going to be an open seat when I started. I actually thought that it was going to be an open seat. I believed that Mayor Goldsmith would not run for a third term. Had I believed he was going to run for a third term, I don't. I think I probably would not have run. But I believed it would be an open seat. Nobody else believed it would be an open seat, at least on the Democratic side. I don't know what the scuttlebutt among Republicans was, but on the Democratic side, everybody assumed I'd be running against Steve Goldsmith, and most of them weren't overly optimistic about my chances in that kind of a contest.
But in 95, he did not do very well, even though he won against sitting Judge Z. Mae Jemison. His numbers were down, and it might have been... We've recorded a podcast with Paul Okeson and Michael Connor, former chiefs of staff to respective mayors, Ballard and Peterson. And I had heard before that the 95 race was the signal that maybe things are changing. Now, they may not change super quickly, but the numbers are starting to finally turn. Is that something that you looked at, were aware of, factored in?
You know, because the 95 race was... Judge Jemison didn't have a lot of money in that race. I didn't think that was the most representative race, but I looked at a lot of other races. What I did is I started really studying how candidates did in Marion County, how Democrats did in Marion County in statewide races. So I looked at Evan Bayh's races. I looked at Frank O'Bannon's, Jeff Modisett, who was elected Marion County prosecutor, I believe, in 1990. And then was narrowly defeated in 1994. I looked at a lot of different races where a lot of money was spent. And my view was, after all of this very much amateur analysis, that if a Democrat had enough money to get their message out, they could be competitive in Marion County. The common wisdom at that time was that a Democrat couldn't possibly win in Marion County, that the numbers just didn't add up. But I believed that in a fair contest, meaning a contest in which both sides had about the same amount of money, and it turned out that that's the way my race went, actually. I think we spent almost the same amount of money with myself and my opponent in 99. But I believed that if a Democrat could get their message out, they could win. And as each year passed by, I believe the county was starting to move more and more a few Republicans were leaving, a few Democrats were moving in. It was each year the percentages were probably getting a little closer. I don't know what the percentage in 99 was. It could have been anywhere from, 54-55% Republican down to maybe 52% Republican. I don't know, but I believe that there was still a Republican advantage at that point. But it was close enough that in a race where each side had enough money, that it would be effectively a toss-up. And that's the mentality that I had going into it. But again, remember, I didn't think Steve Goldsmith was going to run. And I don't know whether I'd been able to raise any money if Steve Goldsmith had run. But what happened is about 3 weeks before, 2 or 3 weeks before he made the decision not to run, all of a sudden, I became convinced he was going to run. I finally was the last holdout, and I finally gave up and said, you know what? He's going to run, and it's too late to get out. So I think we're in this for better or worse, we're in this thing. But then after the election, it was announced that Indianapolis was not going to get the Republican National Convention. And within a couple of days after that announcement, he announced he was not going to run. I've never asked him this, and he and I have a great relationship, but I've never asked Steve this, if that affected his decision. I'm sure
question.
He would have wanted to be mayor when the Republican National Convention was here, and I think a lot of people thought we would get the convention that year. So that would have been 2000 for
Mitch
the 2000.
Daniels was unhappy that it didn't come here that year.
Yeah. I think everybody was, actually. I mean, it in retrospect, except me. But, we all realized it would have been good for the city. But I was had in mind that influenced his decision, that he probably wasn't going to run, but that he couldn't pass up that chance to be the host, a mayor for the Republican
convention. That's a
reasonable
calculation.
So, but anyway, it was only a day or two after that announcement was made that he announced that he was not going to run. And then from then on, it was an open seat race, which obviously changed the dynamic entirely. I was able to, raised a lot of money for the campaign.
But the theory of running, of crunching the numbers and talking with your friends and having conversations over lunch, there's that. And then there's signing your name to the candidate filing paperwork. How did you go from the former to the latter? Like the you mentioned the open seat, but you didn't know at the time, but in the Marin County was maybe trending a little bit. But clearly there must have been some tough conversations, some fun conversations with your friends and family to make you write your name and file that paperwork with the clerk.
Well, I think anybody who has any success in politics is somehow driven internally. I've always said if you have to go talk somebody into being a candidate for something, odds are they're going to lose, unless it's such a lopsided race that they can't lose. Because you really have to be driven internally by it. You have to believe somehow that you want to be there and you want to win more than anything in the world. Because it's extremely hard, as you well know. It's incredibly demanding on every aspect of your life, and you have to sacrifice a lot in order to do it. But it doesn't feel like sacrifice, and it doesn't feel like work if you are totally and completely committed to it. And pretty early on, I got totally and completely committed to it. And I believed that if I did everything I needed to do, that I would win, and that nobody... if I did lose, it wasn't going to be because I was outworked. I was going to work harder than anybody else possibly could in that race. And part of that is motivated by just what you said. When you sign those candidate papers, it's too late. Your name's going to be on the ballot. Do you want to be humiliated, or do you want to acquit yourself well, win or lose? And if you're going to acquit yourself well, you better do everything that it takes. You better work every single minute. You better raise all the money you can raise. You better go speak everywhere you can speak. You better use whatever ingenuity you have to figure out the right strategy. You better believe that there's something worth running for. And, you know, I love this city. I lived my whole life in this city. And I just believed, not that we needed to turn it around. Heck, we were on a good upward trajectory. I wanted to keep it going and add, you know, some of my own ideas to it. And so I was kind of a true believer in my own candidacy. And I also was, like I think anybody else with any sense who gets involved in politics, I didn't want to lose. And I was going to spend every spare moment I could, every opportunity I had to try to convince one more voter I was going to take, because I didn't want to lose. As much as I wanted to win, I also didn't want to lose. And I think, you know, back to your point about once you can talk about it, but then you got to sign those papers. When you sign those papers, you better be all in.
When you decided to run, did then Senator Evan Bayh say, "Run, Bart, run"?
Well, nobody really said "Run, Bart, run." I have to tell you, I think I only had one person ever before I decided to run tell me, "Bart, you ought to get involved in politics. You ought to run for mayor."
Do we know this person?
Yeah, I'm not going to say his name. He knows who he is. I often mention him. I often, when I see him, I mention that point that he was the only person that ever said that to me. But no, I think everybody thought it was, like I said, the conventional wisdom was it wasn't time, you know, maybe someday, but not today. And again, people thought Steve Goldsmith would run and that he would add unlimited money and be very, very hard to raise money in a campaign like that. And all of those things were true, with the exception of the fact that I did believe that the county was trending toward being closer to 50-50. And I also just, like I said, I had this belief in my own campaign, and I figured if we could put a good team together, which we did, we had a great team. If we could stay disciplined, have a clear message, and work hard, that we had a 50-50 chance. Now, I thought it was 99-1 chance sure. in favor of winning, but I couldn't say that to people. That would come across as crazy. But, you know, I think eventually we got to a point where people thought there was a 50-50 chance we could win. And when you have that, then you can start raising money. People will start working for you, volunteering for you, those kinds of things that help make a campaign really work.
When the Republicans nominated Sue Ann Gilroy, part of the Lugar family, it was the sitting Secretary of State, did that change the dynamic for you at all, running against the first female Republican nominee for the mayor of Indianapolis? Was that a different challenge than perhaps you were anticipating?
No, I never thought about it as a challenge because Sue Ann was a woman. I thought it was a challenge because she had name identification. And she certainly had she was a Republican establishment figure. She wasn't a fringe character or something like that. She was a Republican establishment figure, which meant that, you know, there probably wasn't going to be anybody against her within the party. And she had some level of name identification from her years as Secretary of State. So I thought she would be a very effective candidate for Republicans. I thought the only disadvantage that she had, and correspondingly advantage I had, was that she was kind of anointed. And I think that when you're anointed, sometimes that just automatically makes people a little bit, some people a little bit irritated. People who have a tendency to be anti-establishment, you know, if the establishment anoints somebody, they just want to be against them just for that reason.
We've seen that plenty of times recently.
Yeah, it's a phenomenon in politics, and I thought that might be a little bit of a disadvantage for her that wasn't her fault. I mean, there was nothing she could do about that because it was only slightly less than a year before the election when Mayor Goldsmith announced that he was not going to run. So somebody most likely was going to be anointed, although it could have been left wide open and, you know, see who earned it.
And refresh my memory, did you have a primary opponent in 99?
I did. I had one or two primary opponents, but they were sort of, perennial candidates.
Sure.
Yeah.
The decision to formulate and print, release, promote the Peterson Plan, please talk about that decision. And that's A. And B, when was the last time you read it?
The last time I read it. I actually did read it many, many times. But no, I haven't read it for a very long time. It's hard for me to believe it's been 20 years since we, few months more than 20 years since we published that. I'll tell you where it came from. It partially from me and partially from Mike O'Connor, who was my campaign manager then. I never intended it to be published. It was my experience in working as a staffer for Evan Bayh's first gubernatorial campaign was that if you plan things out and you put a plan together, a written plan, then you actually have something to follow once you get into office. So the way that experience worked is I brought a bunch of people together who were supporters of Evan's, who were interested in environmental issues, and we put a plan together. It was probably a 30-page plan. He did a press conference and announced it a couple months before the election. Nobody paid any attention to it. But once we once he got into office, we started following that plan. And with its 5, 6, 7 different legislative proposals and all kinds of, you know, administrative proposals, all this stuff we said we were going to do, he said we were going to do, nobody paid any attention to. We started doing them. And then that was 88. He took office in 89. Then in 1990, the environment all of a sudden became this huge issue in America for a number of reasons. And all of a sudden, I'm doing TV interviews and legislative environmental issues at the legislature are the most followed issues. It was amazing. But we had a plan. And so we actually had something to say and something to do when circumstances made the environment a big issue. What I told my team, my campaign team in 1999, was that when you get into office, all hell breaks loose. No matter what you think, you have all this time to plan. You may think you're busy on a campaign, but you're not busy in a campaign compared to how busy you are when you're in office. And all of a sudden, everybody's priority is being jammed down your throat. Everybody wants you to do what they want you to do.
That's right.
And then things start to happen, right? Stuff happens in the environment, the environment in the broadest sense.
Sure.
Things just start happening in the world that you have to deal with. I never had any plan to deal with the Indianapolis Colts. It ended up being a dominant thing during my administration was to negotiate a deal with the Colts and ultimately build the stadium. But I never even thought about that before I was elected. So stuff happens when you get into office. If you don't walk into office with a blueprint, with a plan about what you're going to do, you're just going to be like somebody who's on a raft out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean with no navigation equipment. I mean, you can start to, you know, paddle your little raft in one direction, but you have no idea what direction you're going.
Well, as press secretary for the Ballard transition team, you are exactly correct, Mayor Peterson.
Yeah,
that's exactly right.
Yeah. And so when you win in a surprise win, you tend not to have all those things planned out.
Exactly right.
But I had that experience from the Biden administration, so I wanted to have a plan, and we had a lot. We had something like 50 people did research and helped put that plan together.
We talked to David Harris a little bit about it.
Yeah, he was exactly. Very involved in it. Jane Henniger, who became my deputy mayor, was oversaw the production of it. And we had a lot of people working for a long time on it. For me, it was just a blueprint for what we were going to do when we got there. I might talk about elements of it because it related to the three main pillars of my campaign. But the three main pillars of my campaign were the three main sections of the Peterson plan. But I never thought we would publish it and put it in campaign ads. That was Mike's idea. And in fact, I tried to talk him out of it, show you what an astute politician I was. I tried to talk him out of it, but he convinced me. And of course, it ended up being probably the most important thing that we did.
When this podcast airs, it will be 2 days after the 20th anniversary of your win in 99. How much of election night do you remember? And to the extent that you remember it, and I'm sure you do, what was that feeling like?
Well, it's a very nice feeling. Obviously, you've been working. I've never been an athlete, although I love sports. I can imagine what somebody feels like at the end of a college or professional season in football or basketball, when they win the championship, you just think back on all the hard work and the team and the camaraderie that you developed with your teammates and all that kind of thing. That really was probably, that's what felt the best, was just that we all did it together and we were a team and it felt good to celebrate with your teammates. It is not in this business, the business of politics, it's not something that lasts terribly long, because you realize you wake up the next morning and that period of time between the election and the inauguration, which looked really like a long period of time, and you don't want to do too much planning ahead of time, you know, because you don't want to take your eye off the ball. You got to win the election first. We had a lot of work to do, so it, you know, reality hit pretty quickly thereafter. But it's pretty exhilarating. I'll tell you for me at least, the most interesting story from that night. Remember, this is 1999. There are no other major elections going on. There are, you know, probably a dozen big city elections going on around the country. You know, that's about it. It's an odd numbered year. There are no Senate races, no congressional races, no presidential race. So the mayor's races got a fair amount of attention, and Bill Clinton was president of the United States. Al Gore was vice president. I got a call from both of them that night, a call from the president and the vice president that night. Now, I don't know if everybody who won those big city races got those calls, but certainly because we had flipped a city that had been in Republican control for 32 years, it was a little more closely watched. Same thing happened in Columbus, Ohio that night, I believe. And Manchester, New Hampshire. I remember President Clinton talking about how amazing it was that we won Manchester, New Hampshire.
Related to the New Hampshire primary?
Absolutely. That's why people
pay attention to Manchester. So the day before the election, you're talking to Scott Chin. And yeah. the night of the election, you're talking to...
And I admire them both equally. But the reason I bring that up is everybody sort of knows the personality of those two men. And they were on full display that night. Bill Clinton kept talking. President Clinton kept talking so long. I almost told him I had to leave to go, you know, give my speech. I almost had to hang up on the president because he was just sort of going, you know, like he had nothing else to do. And that's, he was sort of famous for that. You know, he was always late to everything because he just kept talking and listening and he loved conversation. Al Gore just... it was like he was reading from a script, you know. Congratulations, Bart. You know, we are very proud of you. You know,
say with feeling.
So, you know, I admired Al Gore, but he sort of didn't have the same sort of smoothness, let's say, that Bill Clinton had, which I got to see on full display.
One thing I want to make sure that we're clear on as we talk about your years as mayor. And I would say, I would imagine that Richard Lugar would definitely say the same, considering who worked for him and certainly now deceased Mayor Bill Hudnut. And we're putting together a retrospective podcast on the Hudnut years as mayor with Joe Slash and Lisa Dietrich and Dave Arlen. And Goldsmith would say the same, the immense talent in the mayor's office. But when I have people who are meeting Mayor Ballard for the first time and they go, what's it like? You know, what should I tell him? I go, compliment his staff as mayor. If you compliment his staff as mayor, he's putty in your hands. And looking back at the people who worked for you, it's a terrific collection of talent. Whether it's Michael Connor, Melina Kennedy, Kobe Wright, Scott Chin, Steve Campbell, Justin Ohlmiller, Terry Morris Downs, my personal favorite because she's an Eastsider. Mm. The list goes on and on and on and on. You mentioned a little bit earlier about your reunion. Just quickly, how proud are you of these then young men and women who worked for you?
Oh, I can't tell you how proud I am. I loved working with them. I loved them as people. I've, you know, taken great joy in watching their careers. I take no credit for it. They're enormously talented people. I'm glad that I had the office that I had, which created opportunities for them or had positions that they could fill where they could use their creativity, their intelligence, their drive, their discipline, all those things that make people successful. They had a chance to put those on full display, just the way I did when I was a staff person for Governor Bayh. And you know, they made a difference in this city. They really helped change this city for the better, just as other mayor's staffs have had the opportunity to do in the past and will in the future. So I just couldn't be more proud. And it's interesting you would say that about Mayor Ballard. I'm the same way. When people compliment me, it doesn't. I appreciate it, but it doesn't really mean that much to me because I know that I was just one of many who worked hard. And I know that where the best ideas came from, and I know where the hardest work came from, and I know where the breakthroughs came from. They came from my team. And it was just a great group of people who made a huge difference for this city. And I'm really, really proud of them. And they've, like I said earlier, they've done so many great things since then. And I'm not going to start naming names because that's a dangerous path to go down. But
Jennifer Smith Simmons, Barbara Lawrence, the list goes on and on. David Harris. It was a incredible collection of talent.
Yes, it was.
Let's talk about your 8 years as mayor. I'm going to throw just two or three issues out or things that happened and let you take it from there. Human rights ordinance.
Yeah, you know, I when RFRA came up in 2015 here in the state, I I had a faulty memory of the human rights ordinance in Indianapolis. I had thought that it passed a lot easier than it did. In fact, it was a kind of a catastrophe almost. We actually lost the vote the first time, and had to go back for a re- I can't remember exactly what we did, but we had to go win some votes after either we lost a vote or it appeared we were going to lose a vote on that. And it ended up passing, I think, just by one vote, so in the city council. So that ended up being a really big fight. And I remember it being a great success for the city. I just forgot how tough it was to get that done. And as any politician who's been in office in the last 20 years, or starting about when I did in 2000 up till today, will tell you, everybody will tell you this, there is no single issue that has moved as quickly as rights for the LGBT community, LGBTQ community in this country, in this state, and in this city. Nothing has moved as far and as fast. You know, we all know very famously that President Obama was against same-sex marriage as a candidate in 2008. And yeah, I was already out of office by then. So it really, from about the mid, you know, decade of the 2000s, from about the middle of that decade to the time when the Supreme Court ruled, which is about a 10-year period, that issue just completely flipped. And today there's even more support for same-sex marriage and LGBTQ rights than there was 4 years ago.
The Mayor's Office of Charter Schools.
Yeah,
one of the single greatest accomplishments of any executive, state or local, in the history of Indiana. Absolutely, 100%.
Let's just leave it at that. Why should I speak and ruin it?
You know, I will tell you, all credit for that goes to David Harris. David is a remarkable leader, as you know, and one of the unsung heroes nationally. I shouldn't say unsung. I mean, he's actually sung these days among education reformers. But he doesn't have a famous name nationally, except in that group of people who understand what it takes to make a difference in public education. Among that group of a few million people, he is a well-known person, and he really led the way. We set a standard for quality that I think carries on today, and I'm very, very proud that Mayor Ballard, when he took office, believed in what we had done, carried it on, took it to new heights, and Mayor Hogsett even beyond that. So it is, most people, if they ask me what I'm most proud of or what I remember most fondly from my days as mayor, they always think about the visible things like the football stadium or the airport. But to me, it was our work in education reform, and specifically the chartering of schools through the Mayor's Charter School Office.
The Indianapolis Colts win the Super Bowl.
Yeah, that was really nice. I'm first and foremost a fan. And
you grew up a football fan of which team?
The Green Bay Packers, because they had a quarterback named Bart. And at that time, he was the only other human being in the world I knew of named Bart. This was before Bart Simpson ruined the name. Now, no parents will ever name their kid Bart anymore because of Bart Simpson. But back then, Bart Starr was my hero, and my parents were from Wisconsin. And so I was a huge Green Bay Packers fan. But when the Colts came here, you know, I became, like everybody else here, just about, I became a huge, huge Colts fan. So it was just so much fun. As a fan and as a citizen of Indianapolis, it was really, as I think back, going to Purdue, Purdue won the women's NCAA basketball championship in 99. And other than that, I don't think I've ever known a championship in my entire life, except for the Colts winning. So that meant a lot to me personally. But it was, you know, obviously it was huge for the city.
and a really, when we were doing the Colts deal to get the stadium built and to sign the agreement to keep them here for 30 years, when we were doing that, that started off very unpopular. In fact, we had no allies at all.
Colts history hasn't exactly, I mean, you had the Manning right. years and you had some other kind of sporadic, including this year, success, but for years and years.
No, it had been bad. I once sold popcorn and Coke in the Cokes in the stands in order to try to generate publicity to get the a sellout so that the blackout would be lifted for a game. This was like in 2002 or something. But in truth, the fact that the Colts were such good guys, we had a great exemplar in Coach Dungy, you know, who was just a wonderful human being. Peyton Manning, the face of the franchise, a wonderful human being. Guys that everybody liked. There was just something about all that. And they were winning, and that made it possible. Sure. They weren't winning when we first started working on the deal. But by the time the deal had to be voted on and get done, I mean, the Colts were right on the cusp of winning a Super Bowl. Finally, they did. You know, as we think back on that time, they had a run of three or four good years before that.
When it comes to difficulty, please rate, if you would, the decision and the execution of the merging of the police department and the sheriff's department, and how that fit your overall philosophy, which you were committed to both as mayor and after mayor, of government consolidation.
Well, I believe in my bones that government consolidation is essential to save the taxpayers money, to make government more efficient and more effective. And it just irks me to this day to see how much inefficiency there is in government and how much waste with a bunch of offices that don't need to exist. It turned out in retrospect that merging the police and the sheriff's department was easier than merging the fire departments, of which we had 11 in Marion County right. at that time. And we've now merged probably a slight majority, maybe 6 or 7 of those 11 are part of the Indianapolis Fire Department today. When I left office, maybe 3 or 4 were. Mayor Ballard got a few more done.
That's right. I
hope I live to see the day when there's only one fire department in Marion County. But that ended up being the politically difficult one. And the reason is, actually, they were both politically difficult, but that one was more difficult because it involved the townships. And the townships exactly. had their own fire departments. They had their own trustees. Their whole reason to exist really was the fire department that they ran. And so if you took their fire department away from them, they didn't really have much reason to exist. And so they fought it tooth and nail, most of them, two or three in my time, I can think of two, which I think were the two biggest, Washington Township and Warren Township, did agree, their trustees agreed to merge their fire departments into IFD. The merger of the sheriff's and police department was fought tooth and nail by the police union, but ultimately, I think, they didn't have support in the General Assembly. The firefighters, the township trustees, I should say, had support in the General Assembly to stop
exactly.
that. So they did not give us an easy pathway forward from the state legislature. They made it very difficult. There had to be, basically, the trustee had to sign off on it. That's why the only ones we got done were the ones where the trustees agreed. With police and fire, they allowed us to do it in the state legislature. And so we were able to get it done, ultimately, much easier than with the fire merger. Now, the one big difference was, in order to get it done politically within Marion County, I had to give up control of the patrol operations to the sheriff. And then Mayor Ballard reversed that the following year.
Tough decision for you?
Yes, it was a tough decision. I preferred it the way Mayor Ballard did, and he was able to get it done. Sort of one of those Nixon goes to China things. He could get it done as a Republican. I couldn't get it done as a Democrat because we had a Democratic sheriff. And so the result of that was we end up getting to the right place. It was just a year later.
When you decided to run for a third term, was it a tough decision, or was it more of, I just have more work to do? and I enjoy this so much.
You know, I think it was, well, I think it was a stupid decision for one thing in retrospect.
Well, I don't, but, I wouldn't, let me defend that decision. Your 8 years as mayor were terrific years. Greg Ballard said that on the podcast. There's a lot of people who've said that on this Leaders and Legends podcast. I was comms director at the Indiana Republican Party at the time. We all thought you were going to run for governor. It was just a matter of when. Daniels wasn't exactly riding high in the polls in 2007, if people remember correctly. And so that's the race that we thought was coming. But yet you decided to run for a third term. What went into that? And I know you what you said just a few seconds ago, but clearly no one anticipated what happened. And that's just candor.
Yeah, you know, and I when I say it was a stupid decision, that's obviously with the benefit of hindsight. At the time, it seemed like kind of a no-brainer decision. But I actually had, in my own mind, decided I wasn't going to run, and then I changed my mind. And the reason I changed my mind is that, you know, ironically, it was because I feared that we had not as firmly established the charter school work as we needed to. And I say ironically because that's the thing. You know, we've had a great tradition of continuity in Indianapolis, so this isn't the only example. But that Mayor Ballard ended up picking up that torch and carrying it to even greater heights.
He praised you for it in the debate. I remember watching it.
Yeah. So that ended up being the thing I was most concerned about. It ended up being the thing I should have been least concerned about. But I thought that would get undone. My big fear was that was so hard fought. It was so fraught with danger and rear guard actions. We had to fight for the success of that to keep that law in place. We had to fight year after year after year. I thought if I stepped down and somebody else became mayor, that they wouldn't care about it as much as I did, and all that work would get undone. Now, that's not the only reason I decided to do it, but that was sort of my policy reason for deciding to run for a third term. But in retrospect, in all truth, I think running and losing. I remember I was in the Kennedy Presidential Library a few months afterwards, and I heard a recorded speech from President Kennedy saying something I'd never heard before, but it really rang true with me, particularly at that time. He said, "You don't learn anything from winning an election," or I think his exact words were, "They say you don't really understand politics until you've lost an election." And I think that's really true, and I think that's true about in life in general. Failure is a much better educator than success is. Success just tells you keep on doing the same thing over and over again. Failure causes you to really look and say, well, what went wrong and what do I do differently next time? And so for me, it's been a great 12 years since that election. I won't deny how painful it was, but I will say it's been, if I hadn't run, if I had just stepped down as mayor, I'm not sure what I'd be doing now. And I'm very, very happy with everything that's happened in the last 12 years. So I have nothing to complain about.
Did you think about running for governor in 2008?
No, I never. No, not at all.
Never did.
No, I don't think Mitch Daniels could have been beaten.
It turned out that way for sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. I really never did. I know there was some talk about that, but I never thought about it myself.
Oh, I was writing the quotes up in my little office. Since you became a private citizen again, you've had a remarkable career. Eli Lilly, chairman of the board at the Mine Trust, which was created by David Harris after he left the mayor's office. Talk a little bit about your career after the mayor's office. You just mentioned that you've enjoyed it. You've been able to stay involved in Indianapolis, in education. Could there have been a better second act for you than this?
Well, I don't know. You know, life is interesting, and I sometimes envy those people who can do one career their entire lives and they get really good at it. For me, I'm always on a learning curve. I'm always trying to figure out a new field that I've engaged in. I'm very, very, very fortunate. I can't express how fortunate I am to be the CEO of Crystal House International and to have the chance to work with Crystal Dahan and the great team that we have here at Crystal House. And, you know, our motto is transforming lives, and that's really true. This organization's even better on the inside than it looked like to me from the outside. So I'm blessed to have this opportunity. And I think everything I've done has helped me get to the point where I can do this job. The years at Lilly taught me so much about management, about leadership, about business. And I'd been in business before. I grew up in an entrepreneurial family. But a big corporation like Lilly is just a different animal, and I learned so much there, made many good friends, and enjoyed it, and also had a chance to see the world. And all that really helped me to help prepare me for this job. So I've been very, very fortunate. I have, and my father used to say, he came here at the age of 19 from Wisconsin, on a motorcycle, and he came to visit his aunt and uncle in Indianapolis, and through a series of circumstances that we don't have time to talk about, he never left, and he ended up going. He's a true rags to riches story. Had nothing but the motorcycle and maybe $20 in his pocket to his name. Those were his sum total of his assets, and a woman back in Wisconsin who would become his wife and my mother. That's all he really had, and he became very, very successful. And he said to the day he died, he could not have done it anywhere else. And he loved Indianapolis, and he transmitted that to all of his kids. And that's in my DNA. So everything I've ever accomplished and every joy I've had in my life, I really attribute to the good fortune of having grown up in this city. And those 8 years of having a chance to lead it will always be the most memorable of my life. So I'm very grateful.
Does the collaborative nature of the city and its people and its leaders and its volunteers and its organization stay with you? That's been a recurring theme of the podcast. People lay aside whatever differences they have and come together to knock it out of the park or to move the ball forward.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, look at the two of us sitting here talking about this and having been on the other side of each other politically. That you see that over and over and over again, that we all put the city above everything else. And people have asked me, what's the secret of Indianapolis? How can we, other mayors would ask that. You know, we had a good, even when I was mayor, we had a great reputation nationally from the work that my predecessors had done. And that secret sauce is something that I don't know how to tell somebody else about. I don't know how to tell them to have people be self-sacrificing, to have people be willing to put the city above their own business or political interests, because if we can raise the tide, it'll raise all the boats, and we'll all win. We'll all be better off if we work together than if we fight each other. It's so obvious. I mean, the examples are there everywhere, but nobody else does it. Almost nobody else does it. And so I don't really know how to tell somebody how to do it. It's just, I used to say when I was mayor, and Mayor Ballard may have felt the same way, there are certain constraints you have on you, and I say this in a positive way, that if you get too far out of line, if you're not looking out for the city well enough, the forces will come, you know, knock you back into line, because we have a way of doing things here, and it's about collaboration and putting partisanship aside and putting the interests of the city above all else, that we just won't let a politician mess that up. And I'm very proud to live in a city where I can say that.
And I give you two examples of this before we go on to the final five questions. When Indianapolis did not receive the winning nod for the Super Bowl in 2007, the city went after the Super Bowl and didn't get it. As comms director for the Indiana Republican Party, I went to Murray Clark, who was the chairman, and said, what do you want to do? And Murray goes, we need to put out a statement thanking the city for the effort, even though we came up second. This is in the heart of a heated mayoral campaign, and And so maybe as Republicans, it wasn't the best thing we should have done. But for the city to play in that league after all this growth, it was the right thing to do. And I can also say, and I believe it was the summer of 2008, former Mayor Bart Peterson and current Mayor Greg Ballard did a joint news conference talking about the need for government consolidation.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
We sure did.
You are listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast presented by Veteran Strategies, a local veteran public relations enterprise, and sponsored by Girl Scouts of Central Indiana, the Crown Plaza Hotel and Grand Hall and Conference Center at Historic Union Station, and McAllister Machinery, your friendly neighborhood Caterpillar dealer. We end all podcasts with the same five questions. Mayor, are you ready?
Is this a lightning round?
Yeah, probably a little bit. Some of the answers are longer than others as people try to remember. Question number one, what was your first job?
Bagging groceries at Amalia at 106th and College.
What was your first concert?
Neil Young.
Live Rust?
Yes.
That's pretty damn good. If you could recommend any book for someone to read, which book would you recommend?
Oh gosh, I have a million books that I recommend to people. But I recommend one to only a very select group of people. And they are people who are willing to read a 1,200 page book about a person that most people have never heard of. But it's widely regarded as among the greatest biographies ever written. It's the book is Robert Moses and the Fall of New York by Robert Caro, who's more famous for writing a multi-volume biography of Lyndon Johnson. But before that, he won the Pulitzer Prize for his book on Robert Moses. It's called The Power Broker. I'm sorry, that's the name of the book. The Power Broker, Robert Moses and the Fall of New York. One of the most amazing characters in the history of our country, who basically built the modern New York and lost his soul in the process. But you got to be a little bit intense to want to read that book, The Power Broker by Robert Caro.
If you could witness any event in history, be there as it happens, which event would you choose?
Lincoln's second inaugural address. My favorite words written and spoken by an American statesman.
That's positively brilliant. If you could have dinner with anyone living today, last question, 2 hours off the record, whom would you choose?
Oh my gosh. That's a tough one. Anyone living today? All right. Pete Buttigieg.
Mayor of South Bend.
I might actually be able to pull that off. If
how's going I say? Haven't I you could, not already?
Yeah. Not 2 hours.
In 1999, Bart Peterson and his team ended 32 years of Republican mayorality in this city. And it's safe to say that perhaps the voters of Indianapolis took a flyer on some folks that may or may not have heard of. We are very fortunate that they did so. The 8 years of the Peterson administration were terrific years for the city, and we cannot thank him enough for his time today. And we must acknowledge again the amazing quality of his staff and all the work they continue to do in this city and beyond. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, Robert. I appreciate your kind words.
Thank you very much for listening to Leaders and Legends, brought to you by Veteran Strategies Incorporated. If you want to contact us about this program or our menu of public relations services, please send us an email at robert@veteranstrategies.com. That's robert@veteranstrategies.com.